Welcome to Copenhagen Daily, reporting from the Bella Center in Copenhagen, on what is undoubtedly the most important meeting in human history. Welcome to Copenhagen Daily on Monday the 14th of December 2009. It's the second week of the United Nations Climate Talks open here in the Bella Center in Copenhagen. We've got five items on the show today. We check in with the Rainforest Action Network's Policy and Research Director, Bill Barclay, on the status of the forestry discussions in the light of the draft text published here late on Friday. We've got three more testimonials from representatives of the Global South that are here in Copenhagen at the People's Summit, or Klima Forum. We've got an extract from the Friends of the Earth press briefing discussing how the EU can make a 40% cut in greenhouse gas emissions by 2020 without using offsets. And we've got a report from yesterday's Hit the Production Action at the port. But we're going to start with Tom and Arthur's journey on the Camp for Climate Action coach.
Hello, you are listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I am Tom Besley.
Hi, I'm Arthur. We're on our way to Copenhagen. We just got on the coach and heading out from the embankment in London. Copenhagen, here we come. Are you excited, Tom?
Yeah, absolutely. We're actually going down the Strand, I think, and we'll be going past the cop-out, camp-out occupation of Trafalgar Square, which I think is still there, I'm not sure.
Last I've heard, they're still camping out there. And if you don't know, that's a demonstration really connected to the Copenhagen talks organised by Climate Camp. So, you know, there are demonstrations going on all over the world, really. I mean, last weekend there was the wave, wasn't there, which we were both there.
Oh, that was a lot of fun. About 40,000 people dressed in blue. So we're at Dover now, and we got through without any trouble from the police. That was good.
Yeah, indeed.
This is Arthur, reporting for Resonance FM. I'm here on the Dover to Calais ferry. We're just sitting around a table. A few of us have had some food, and I'm sitting here with a few people from Climate Camp. What's your name?
I'm Deborah.
Bill.
Nick.
Jamie.
So, first of all, what are you guys looking forward to this week?
I'm really looking forward to meeting loads of activists from all over the world and finding out what they're up to, and hopefully making some plans, just getting a feel for what people are intending to do over the next couple of years. I don't think that what's going to go on inside the conference is going to be particularly interesting. I don't think it's going to achieve very much.
How about you, Nick? Are you looking forward to it?
Kind of like much the same, really. I've only really just started being involved in Climate Camp and protest, and I think the whole networking thing is something that I'm really looking forward to, kind of getting more of a feel for what the rest of Europe and the rest of the world, like what the movement's doing. And really interesting, it's like the first really major kind of like protest action type thing that I've been on, so it's quite exciting from that point of view.
How about you? You look a bit more like an old hand.
I'm actually quite a new hand. I'm a video maker, calloused. I'm just coming because I'm really interested to cover what is quite an important, it's almost like probably the most important turning point in my life, maybe politically, where the world can actually try and sort itself out, or whether we're just going to slide down the climate disaster slope. I'm also really interested to see how the kind of activists are using the internet to coordinate their actions, and also to see what are the different techniques that people from other countries use.
That's really interesting. I guess a big part of why the climate camp people here is for protest and direct action. How do you feel about that side of things? Do you think that there's a real opportunity to influence the outcomes of the conference?
I think that my attitude to it might be a bit different to some other people from climate camp. Like, I feel quite strongly that unless the G77 or the African countries group walk out, that we shouldn't be trying to disrupt the talks, because, you know, they want the UN... They want the UN to be the body that is managing this problem, because what they're really terrified of is that it's going to be the WTO, the World Bank, which is managing this problem. And you know, like, the UN, yes, like, it's got these massive problems in it, but a lot of those problems are actually just to do with the simple idea of trying to get everyone talking to each other, which I think is a good idea and a good principle. And yeah, it's really difficult, but unless, like, it's very, very possible that they will walk out. And if they do, then I think that we have every right to be like, this conference does not have a mandate, it doesn't have a platform, and we, the activists here, are representative. We're helping to represent the people that have walked out. But unless if they don't walk out, I don't see how we're more representative than they are.
I certainly agree with that, in a way that, personally, I feel that. I try and imagine what a conference like this would be like without any protests, and that to me seems like it would be a complete mistake for this to go unnoticed and just allow our leaders to make the decisions on our behalf without showing that we care about it. Is this something that you feel, that protests has a powerful role to play in this sense?
Yeah, I mean, protests can be a really positive thing, and like you were saying, climate camp isn't just a load of people coming and saying no to things. Like, we've recently, in a national gathering, like, come up with basically an initiative where we all have to kind of work in a kind of more social context, working at grassroots community groups, and trying to work in that kind of way, in a positive, constructive way, from the bottom up, which is something that we perhaps haven't done so much. We've done individually, but not perhaps as climate camp before. And I think that's a really positive kind of step in the right direction.
Yeah, we're about 50k from the border. We just drove past a field of wind turbines.
They've been pretty constant, actually. I really noticed them here. There's constantly been turbines on the horizon, and I think that really shows how Germany has chosen to invest a lot of money into renewable energy. They get about 8 or 9% of their energy from renewable sources, and I think some estimates say that's created about a quarter of a million jobs in Germany, which is... is really a route that the UK and other countries could pursue a lot more aggressively. So let's just talk to one of our fellow passengers. How was your night's sleep?
Remarkably good, actually. I avoided the tendency to try and fidget and get comfortable, and it all worked out really well.
It would have been a lot more comfortable on a plane, though, right? Just 2 or 3 hours straight to Copenhagen.
I don't know, I don't have a cold, which is quite nice. And it's nice to travel. I actually feel we've travelled from London to Copenhagen and with a bunch of really nice people. It's been fun. We've had good conversations and it's been a nice process. And it's like 1,000% more efficient than flying in terms of carbon emissions. So I'm pretty happy with the arrangement.
Do you think also there's a political reason for getting the coach rather than flying?
Well, I think that the clue is the 1,000% more efficient in terms of carbon emissions. But yeah, I mean, I think obviously there is a certain irony to turning up to a climate summit in the most damaging form of transport. Much as I think the importance of this summit is so great that the emissions are relative to the importance of what we need to get out of it are very, very minor as an issue, I reckon.
Absolutely. Any thoughts on the next border crossing, Tom? We're going to be there in, I guess, half an hour or so, and from reports it sounds quite heavy-handed, doesn't it?
I think as long as we're sensible about things, leave our knives at home, we'll be all right.
Great. Well, we'll let you know how it goes once we're there. Claire, could you explain what's going on?
We're standing in a lay-by somewhere, surrounded by police, and we've all been searched one by one. And we've all had to take our luggage off the bus into a big white tent and have all our stuff looked at in our bags. And now we're just waiting for the search of the bus to finish, and then we'll all be on our way. So we're all sitting outside the bus. It's pretty cold, but it's, the sun's glorious and shining, and it's quite a nice vibe actually. The police are very friendly, and there's a police dog kind of jumping around wagging his tail. It's quite nice.
Yeah, I think after all the anticipation of getting to the border, and whether we'd be like hassled or stop getting through, if there'd be injections just going through, it was all like quite a bit of build up after all the travelling to get here, so it's quite a relief that everything seems to be falling into place. And it is a tad intrusive, like having all your stuff picked through bit by bit, but it looks like we're coming out the other end fine, which is great, which is a relief.
My name is Bernd Schindler. I'm the press officer of the German police here in this control station.
Okay, and could I ask you just what's the purpose of this operation here?
It's only COP15, you know, in Copenhagen. And we are here to looking for some weapons or anything else. We hope that the demonstrations in Copenhagen will be calm and quiet. And therefore we are here, and we are searching for people they don't want to make it calm and quiet.
Have you had any problems at all this week?
No, we had no problems. We had only friendly people in this control station the last 2 days. No problems.
And just on a kind of personal note, what do you think of the climate conference in Copenhagen?
Well, it's not my opinion to say something about this. I'm only here for the police and not for my private.
Approaching Copenhagen now. The bus. It's getting dark. But we hear the centre of Copenhagen is jammed with protesters, which is, it's a good thing, but it might delay our trip. Also, the social centre we were going to stay at is full, so we'll be heading a bit further out of town. So I guess these inconveniences for us are generally good news. There's lots of people there. On the streets and coming from all corners of Europe. What are you afraid of this week?
Just getting a bit overwhelmed and bottling out and running off and hiding in a hotel room.
Okay, fair enough. And you?
I guess finding myself in a situation where I don't really know what's going on, like it's hard to, you want to do the thing that's going to be most effective. If the thing that's being most effective is getting rested and being reported and that being part of the story, then maybe that's it. But it might be that in the moment you have no idea.
The cold.
And you?
Yeah, similar to you, really finding myself in a situation where I feel like the reasons that I've been put, the reasons I've gone, have been hijacked by others for their own ends, and that I end up in a situation which is not representative of something that I believe in.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And despite all those concerns raised there, I think we can all say that we're all feeling fairly positive about the...
Really excited. Yeah. Definitely really excited.
A lot of things could go really right. As well, like I think we focus on negatives a lot, which is good because we cover our backs, but things could go really well and we're all going to have fun.
The draft forestry text was leaked to the Ecosystems Climate Alliance here at the Bella Centre on Friday night. The ECA is a coalition of environmental and social campaign groups working together on forestry issues here at the UN Climate Talks. The coalition includes Environmental Investigation Agency, Global Witness, Wetlands International, Rainforest Foundation UK and others. The ECA put out a rapid response condemning the text on forestry, or RED as it's known in conference speak, as a deal that would fail to reduce emissions from deforestation, threaten the indigenous peoples who rely on forests for their livelihoods, and have severe negative impacts on biodiversity. The text has removed all targets for ending deforestation and significantly weakened language for ensuring safeguards for biodiversity, indigenous rights and monitoring, which has moved from operational text into warm words in the preamble. There's no commitment from rich countries to providing the necessary finance, and the language on the responsibility of rich countries to tackle the drivers of deforestation have been downgraded from operational text to symbolic words in the preamble. There is still no provision to protect and restore the world's peat soils, which account for 6% of all global CO2 emissions. I spoke to Bill Barclay, the Policy and Research Director of Rainforest Action Network.
I mean, the stakes are really, really high right now, and the heads of state are coming next week, so there's a lot of pressure to come out with text, but it's still very dynamic, and there's a couple of issues that are going to be elevated up to the ministerial level. Part of this global targets, part of making sure that safeguards are really operationalized, and so we're still hopeful that we can get pressure onto the ministerial level to make sure that they make a good decision on this. So. But the stakes are high, very high right now.
Perhaps the big players in here are really all the kind of corporations and the banks that are already setting up these kind of pilot projects. They're almost like determining the rules of the game in advance of the democratic discussion, ahead of the democratic discussion. Do you think that's been problematic?
It's definitely a factor. I mean, there's a lot of money that is looking to get involved in RED and for, you know, very quick financial gain. And that is a huge factor and a problem in these discussions. Most of these countries are just not ready for this kind of free market activity yet in the forest sector. That's the bottom line. There needs to be a lot of investment in helping these countries get their forest sector in order, getting social communities, rights recognized, and a lot of other issues. And until that happens, RED just won't work. It's just going to be a huge problem, a huge mess, and a big source of conflict. And that's not a solution for saving rainforests. If you look at demarcated indigenous territories and you look at deforestation rates, I mean, they're very, very low deforestation rates. And you can even see deforestation right up to their borders from satellite, and then it stops. And that's because those territories are demarcated. And in a similar way, forests that are community-based, community-controlled forests have much better record of maintenance and quality of forest than other types of tenures, like industrial tenures and most government tenures. So it really demonstrates the importance of involvement and ownership at the local level to make sure that we have an actually effective RED. And that's something that often seems to be missing in these talks here.
And as you were saying, that there was a paper, was it in Scientific America, a scientific paper that was published recently that kind of confirmed this?
Yeah, there was a review, there was a recent scientific paper which reviewed community-owned forests around the world and demonstrated that they have much lower deforestation rates, much lower degradation rates, and much higher benefits for local communities. So it's a very, very useful model to actually see, can we get these kinds of models actually supported through this process rather than disadvantaged, excluded, or ignored. So these are the kinds of issues that will make or break the effectiveness of the agreements here.
Going back to the question of tackling demand and reducing the drivers of deforestation, there's some model legislation that could be rolled out perhaps that's been put forward in the U.S.?
Yeah, the U.S. has something called the Lacey Act, which makes it illegal to actually import, distribute, or sell forest products that come from illegal sources. Sensible, very clear rule. I mean, the significance of this, 50% of tropical timbers that enter international trade are estimated to come from illegal sources. And the markets are in the north, a lot of the markets are in Europe and in the U.S., and so this illustrates the importance, actually, of these countries working with countries where these products, illegally sourced wood products, are coming from, to actually get laws, get the legal situation in control. I mean, this revenues are going to sort of syndicates, mafia syndicates, criminal elements. I mean, it's lost revenues to governments. It's a real problem, actually. It's a very significant problem. And we are complicit to the extent that we are continuing to purchase these products. And it's a loss of revenues, and it's a loss of damage to forests for people who do depend on them. That really is something that needs to be addressed quite urgently. So it's just a new law. It's just come into effect. I think there's nothing like sort of a legal compliance to capture the attention of businessmen and, of course, forest product supply chains are very complex. They're very large. They're very global. And we live in a globalized economy now. And so people are starting to pay attention. And it's interesting, too, because so much of forest products, paper and such, is now going through China. And so China, of course, has business relationships and depends very much on business relationships in the United States. So you start to see a kind of positive effect where U.S. businesses are now requiring their Chinese suppliers to provide them with assurances of the source, of the legality of the sources of the products. And so you get a very positive effect actually back to the supply chain, and this is what's so important: bring more transparency to this trade in forest products.
We'll bring you more on the forestry story as the week unfolds. Last week we flagged up the Stockholm Environment Institute's report for Friends of the Earth, showing how Europe can reduce its emissions by 40% by 2020 without using offsets. This kind of bold action is the least that Europe needs to do if Copenhagen is to be a success. We think this is so fundamental to what's going on here that we make no excuse for highlighting this again. Here's an extract from the Friends of the Earth press briefing on the report.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our news conference. I'm Nick Burning. I work with Friends of the Earth US. There have been a lot of questions about whether it's actually possible to reduce emissions at the rate that both science and justice demand. And today we're here to discuss a report that says the answer is yes. The report is called Europe's Share of the Climate Challenge. And we're going to discuss both the detailed policy analysis, and then we also have a summary report with some policy recommendations, and both documents will be available afterward if you'd like. We have three distinguished panelists. The first is Charlie Heaps. He is the senior scientist at the Stockholm Environmental Institute and is the lead author of the report. He's going to talk about the findings and some of the specific policies that will be needed. Sonia Meister is coordinator of the Climate Justice and Energy Campaign at Friends of the Earth Europe. And in that capacity, she works on generating strong policy at the European Union level. She's going to talk about the implications of the report for European policy. Our third panelist is Nemo Bassi. He is chair of Friends of the Earth International. He is also head of Environmental Rights Action, which is a group in Nigeria. And he's going to put the report into a global context and discuss what it means at these negotiations. So we can go ahead and get started. I'll turn it over to Charlie.
Thanks very much. So what I'd like to do is just try and give you a very brief overview of some of the main methodology or the approaches used in the report. If you do want to see more detail, I do encourage you all to pick up a copy of it because you know, most of the detailed numbers are available here in the report. So our study really has sort of two main parts to it. It examines how Europe can show climate leadership, both by undertaking domestic actions to rapidly reduce emissions, and also by fulfilling its international obligations to help developing countries address the crises of development and climate change. We start very much from the point of view of what the science says needs to be done, and this chart here shows you a couple of sort of key trends. So one thing you can see at the top line, the orange line, is a 2 degrees C emergency pathway. It's the kind of pathway in greenhouse gas emissions that's going to be required to keep climate change within safe limits, within 2 degrees C. So that's kind of like the bottom line that the globe as a whole has to stay within. If we think about Annex 1 countries and think about very aggressive reductions in Annex 1 countries, and then subtract that from the 2 degrees pathway, you can see that by subtraction, what's left is the pathway for non-Annex 1 countries. So you can see that even with extremely aggressive reductions in Annex 1 countries, there really is not a whole lot of space left for developing countries to continue to develop and to meet their development aspirations within the overall climate budget that science says is left to us. So that's the starting point for this report. You know, we've started by thinking about what is that budget available to Annex 1 countries. So in terms of international obligations, we also look at Europe's overall international obligations for assisting the developing world to make a transition to a low greenhouse gas future. So the overall approach that we've used it comes from the Greenhouse Development Rights Framework, which is a basis for thinking about fair contributions to the overall climate burden-sharing effort. That report is also available from SEI. You can see the cover of it there, or you can download it from gdrights.org. So using the GD Rights Framework, we've estimated what we think is Europe's fair share of the climate burden, and it actually comes to a number that is maybe a little counterintuitive. It comes to reductions of 103% below its 1990 emissions. So, you know, how can it be bigger than 100%? Well, it can only be understood if you think of it being in terms of two obligations. One is to do domestic actions, but the other is to assist the developing countries with their own mitigation efforts. That translates, in terms of the international efforts, that translates into a very large number, between 150 billion and 450 billion, which is maybe between 1 and 3% of the EU's projected 2020 GDP. Now, in turning to domestic actions, the way we've addressed this is to look at a very detailed mitigation scenario of the kind of actions that can be undertaken by Europe within Europe, so not including offsetting, but the kind of actions that can be done within Europe to address climate change. So we prepared a very detailed scenario for all 27 EU countries that aims at two targets, a 40% reduction relative to 1990 values by 2020 and close to 90% by 2050. And what we find is that in fact, can be achieved. It will require a massive effort, but it can indeed technically be achieved through a combination of very radical efficiency improvements, the accelerated retirement of fossil fuels, and a dramatic shift towards various types of renewables, including wind, solar, wave, geothermal, and biomass-based CHP. In this particular scenario, at the request of Friends of the Earth, we've excluded certain options, including nuclear power, carbon capture and storage, and biofuels. And we haven't looked at offsetting, so we're really focusing on achieving those targets domestically within Europe. We've also looked at issues of sufficiency equity in lifestyles. So this scenario is very much a scenario of Europe continuing to grow and get richer in the future, but we have looked at a number of issues such as having a more equal Europe in the future, so there's faster growth in poorer countries, less growth in richer countries. We've also looked at the issue of lifestyle changes, so we looked at healthier diets, more leisure time, increased share of public transport. Just a couple of charts from the scenario. I haven't got time to show you in very much detail at all, but some of the key aspects are, you can see some of it here, a very radical improvements in efficiency, which does seem to be possible, and also switching to lower carbon fuels. So we're phasing out coal very rapidly. We're also phasing out oil and gas where possible, switching to CHP and renewables, but very dramatic improvements in energy efficiency. I'm going to skip that one. On the supply side, a very radical switch to electric generation to various types of renewables, very rapid phasing out of coal. So these things do seem to be possible. There's sufficient wind power available, there's sufficient wind potential and sufficient renewable potential to provide these kinds of energy requirements. It also seems to be possible to build the kind of renewables that you need quickly enough. It's going to require a big mobilization, but it does seem to be possible. And then finally, just in terms of cost of mitigation, we've done a kind of preliminary estimate of the costs, including the major sectors involved, and we find that the costs come to about somewhere between 2 and 3% of GDP, which is broadly consistent with what other studies looking at sort of major transitions are talking about. So remember, to that, though, must be added the Europe's international obligations for helping developing countries do their own transition. And that also comes to a further 1 to 3% of GDP. So the costs are not small, but they're not inconceivably large either. They're somewhere between, we think, 3 to 6% of GDP. But what you've got to balance that against is the cost of inaction. We haven't looked at that specifically in this report, but the most authoritative sources in that regard is probably the Stern Review, which comes up with estimates saying the costs of not acting on climate change are likely to be at least 5% and perhaps as high as 20% of GDP. So yes, this is going to require a major mobilization, but the cost of doing something looks like it's dramatically lower than the cost of not doing something about this problem. And I'll leave it at that for now.
Okay. This presentation from the Stockholm Environment Institute shows us that Europe can live up to its responsibility. We can achieve climate justice, and we can fight dangerous climate change, and we know how urgent it is to act now. The study shows us one possible pathway how to get to 40% domestic emission cuts in Europe by 2020, and we recognize that this is a huge challenge. And this will require major shifts in the way we consume and produce energy, in the way we travel and other issues of our life. But this shouldn't be an excuse to not go this way. The changes that we would see in a decarbonized world in Europe can be positive. We would have a highly efficient economy which is run on renewables. And our cities would have to change. We would have ready and fast public transport, easily accessible areas for pedestrians and other citizens, and also a highly expanded train system, for example. But apparently, there doesn't seem to be the political will to go into this direction. If you look at the commitments of the EU, so far the EU has only committed to their by far insufficient target of 20% cuts by 2020. And you have to take into account the huge amount of offsetting which is included in these targets. And if you look at the current emission data, emissions really went down because of economic recession. We had already been at minus 10.7% emission cuts in the year 2008 in the EU. So a 20% target would mean hardly anything more than a meager continuation of business as usual. I think the study shows us how inadequate and unjust the target is that the EU is bringing here to Copenhagen. EU heads of states are going to meet tomorrow and Friday in Brussels and are going to talk about their position here for Copenhagen. And there have been some countries like Sweden, UK and France who now called on stepping up at least to 30%. But what we would need indeed is the EU to step up the commitments to 40% domestic cuts by 2020. There had been a first move. European Parliament just called end of November on the European Union to step up their commitments to 40%. If you look at the financial contributions the EU was offering, so far they have completely failed to say what they are willing to pay to developing countries. And they even failed to say that we need new public money additional to development aid. So from everything we are seeing now from the EU regarding their targets and financial offers, we are on a safe track to overshoot 2 degrees. And in general, if you look at the current pledges here from developed countries in Copenhagen, they are far from what is needed. And to get a climate agreement here, which is in line with climate justice, is really having a very slim chance. But we believe that the EU could still move the talks more in the right direction if they would step up their commitments now, step up to 40% domestic emission cuts and to paying their fair share of the finances needed. This would also raise the pressure on other developed countries to also step up their efforts. And Europe should finally realize the benefits of actions, first of all compared to the huge cost of inaction, as Charlie just said. But also, there will be about 7 new jobs for every job that we lose in the coal sector and the renewables and energy efficiency sectors. We could have health savings of up to 25 billion euros per year in Europe. So, why is Europe not taking this way? The economic costs and the technical feasibility can no longer be an excuse for politicians not to act now. Science was never clearer than now in telling us what we need to do. And the study shows that there's a possible pathway to achieve 40% domestic emission cuts within Europe without dangerous and unproven solutions. So what we now need is the political will to make this happen and to go beyond politics as usual. So we're calling on European heads of states to step up their commitments and to start doing so tomorrow. Thanks.
Back at the Parallel People Summit, or Klima Forum, here in Copenhagen, Frederica Whitehead recorded these testimonials from majority world civil society participants that have come here to tell their stories.
I'm at the Klima Forum today, and I've come here to meet Haptamariam Abati and Mulu Alam Bihani from Ethiopia. Why did you come to Copenhagen?
I came here to roar, to shout, to appeal for the developed countries. Nobody gave us an attention. Nobody gave us an attention. That is why I came here. You know that we Africans, especially Ethiopians, we have affected by droughts and also diseases. The climate change affected us a lot. We are in a critical point, in a critical condition. We are in the between of death and life.
Can you tell me about your farm and how things have changed because of climate change?
You know, my father is also a farmer and I'm a farmer. Then when I was a childhood and when I was young, it was all months was rainy. When now I'm 53 years old. But before almost 20 years, the drought come. Once the rain come, once the rain is not come. So that we cannot to plow our crops well. In this case, we lost a lot of endemic crops because of this. So we left them. Now we don't have any crop in our hand.
The place where Mulu Alam is residing is one of my project areas. It's a highland.
is more than 2,400 meters above sea level. We have never been experienced mosquitoes around that place. But the last 5 years is a new trend. The mosquitoes ascended to the mountain, and many people are affected by malaria. So in Mulalemis village alone, in a day, 10 people have died.
Ten people?
In a day only, they have buried 10 people.
Because of malaria, and you didn't have malaria in that area
we
before?
We have never experienced it before. So that is one of the devastating effects of climate change. And the other, there are so many on agriculture, on environment as a whole. If I take agriculture, crops which have been growing before, they don't anymore grow around that area. And new crops, which are called lowland crops, they are ascending to the mountain. So there is a shift in cropping mix. So that is another area, another problem. And decline of livestock fertility. Animals do not conceive. So that is also affecting the livestock rearing.
This is because the rise in temperature will affect the reproductive hormones in the cattle.
Sure. It affects the reproductive hormones, and at the same time, because of changing climate, there is no grazing land. There's nothing to eat for animals. So because of that, although they are mad, they don't conceive. That's a major problem. It's an acute and clearly visible impact of climate change in the locality.
And what do you do in Ethiopia?
We are really fighting in two tracks. One, we are appealing for the international community to understand us, to realize our problem. And at local levels, we want our governments to incorporate climate aspects into national development programs and treat and act at the grassroots level. So we are demanding in both tracks.
Mulu Alam, can you tell me what farmers in your country are doing to mitigate climate change?
Yes, in myself, I have got nursery sites, the grass nursery site, and the seedlings, tree seedlings.
Tree plantations, you're planting trees.
Yeah, so I have got around 15 hectares of land. 15 hectares of land. Then I plant a lot of trees.
Okay.
For the mitigation.
What kind of trees are you planting?
Indigenous trees. Indigenous, our country's indigenous trees.
Yeah, okay.
So it uses for water saving, for oxygen, and also to absorb the nitrogen. In our country, we are using different kinds of fuel saving stoves for cooking.
Yeah.
So my wife is working in this, and so she prepares such kind of fuel saving stove.
She helps to distribute the fuel saving stoves to promote fuel saving stoves amongst your area. Is that what you're
telling me? So you see, when you use in previous cooking stoves, we finish a lot of woods.
Yeah, you're saving fuel, you're saving wood.
Yeah, so it has got one, two, three purposes. One, to mitigate. The second one, to save our forests.
Yep.
So we are working such and such. Not only me, a lot of farmers are working in this area.
What do you want the world leaders, the leaders of the developed countries in particular, to agree in these talks?
You know, I expect that they will understand our problem, so the temperature will be one is enough, you know. Now it became
a one degree maximum rise,
because you know now it became too hot. So if it upgrade from one, already will burn. So it must be. It must be the fixed.
I have just met Faye from Fiji. Can you tell me what the effects of climate change are in Fiji?
Okay. For us in Fiji, what we are experiencing is erosion of our coastal areas. We are experiencing sea level rise. We're experiencing extreme weather patterns. and severe weather patterns for that matter as well. So all the current patterns that we have had over the years are now exacerbated as a result of climate change. And so even to the extent of having villages having to move either inland or up island as a result of the rise of the sea levels and inundation of the current village sites.
And what would you like to happen in these talks? What would you like the world leaders to agree over in the Bella Centre where the delegates are meeting now?
Well, for us, our position is taken very much by the Association of Small Island States.
The AOSIS.
The AOSIS countries, in that we are advocating and lobbying for 1.5 degrees, and that is 40% reduction of your 1990 levels of emissions at the bare minimum. And so we're also advocating for a legally binding agreement. We still are. And despite all the reference to the to the contrary, and we hope that that we will get an agreement now that is worth that would safekeep and safeguard our countries and our cultures and our traditions, and that would enable us and the international community to at least have something to give to our future generations. At this current level, if we're not going to get any agreement towards what our reference points are, we feel that our islands and our countries and our cultures will be threatened and will disappear.
And I'm talking to Mamadou Mbodj from Senegal. Mamadou, what direct effects have you witnessed recently as a result of climate change in Senegal?
Yeah, in Senegal, I think let's first talk about the heat. It's getting hotter and hotter, where it used to be cool. And we know also that the coastal area are just degraded drastically. And the desertification is coming quicker and quicker. The trees are dying, and we know also that there is water shortage in my country, and the length of the rainy season also is getting shorter and shorter. These are, roughly speaking, the consequences I can notice.
You come to Copenhagen, you come all the way to Copenhagen. What do you want the world leaders to agree in the talks?
Yeah, I've just come to add my voice to the millions of voices around the world in order to ask the world leaders to try and help Africans adapt to climate change. We know that we polluted less than 4%. And those who polluted, they got the means to face the climate change. But we really we have meaningless. We don't have any means in front of climate change. What we want then is just the financial aspect of climate change.
Yeah.
Let them help us by sending us the new technicals. The new technology, renewable technology. Let them the transfer of new technology, and to finance also many actions we would like to launch in order to adapt ourselves to climate change. Next Saturday, we will take part in a big demonstration in the streets of Copenhagen. It is called the Global Day of Action, and it is synchronized. And all over the world, people will do action in order to urge the world leaders in order to take action, to take decisions right now in order to save the planet. And we used to do that in my country, in Senegal. Since 2007, every Global Day of Action, we try and mobilize people, students and pupils from many schools, and with flags and, you know, boards where we've written some slogans about climate protection, and we walk and explain and show them also the bad effects of climate change.
We end today's programme with Arthur filing this report from the Hit the Production action, which took place at the port yesterday. one of the first actions of what will be a week of protests here in Copenhagen. You've been listening to Copenhagen Daily. If you've missed any of our daily bulletins, you can find them archived at www.climateradio.org. Thanks for listening.
I've come in search of a protest today, which was intending to shut down the harbour. I've come up against a long line of police vehicles, including coaches, serious armoured vehicles. It's attracted quite a crowd watching this massive line of police, and I think the procession should be coming our way shortly. What's your name?
My name is Gita.
You live here in Copenhagen, is that right?
Yes, I do. I live here in Østerbro.
Okay, so right now we're watching a massive amount of police blocking off a road where a protest looks like it might come down. What do you think about all the events going on this week and last week?
If you think about events like where the police is involved, I really don't like it. I think it's scary to live here in Copenhagen and see all the helicopters, and I'm so scared that the police are so trigger happy that something just has to happen, because they've been practicing now for a year and they're really looking forward to beat someone up. I think I really hate it. I'm embarrassed.
What would outcome would you like to see from the conference?
Of course, I would like something completely utopian, that the best thing would happen, but I'm not very hopeful. There's too many economic interests involved in this, so, yeah.
So, you've been involved in the protest today. What happened exactly?
They were cutting the demonstration down in two. And then, we were in the front group, and then they were saying to us, if you can go against the demo, and we are going to search you. And if you don't have anything, you can just walk through with the demonstration. We said it was only like that in 10 minutes, and then we were walking through the demonstration. And then they said that they don't want to get arrested of friends in the back of the group, but they were doing it. And then after we was getting away from the police, there was like, I think, 30 people that was making a sit down, and they were getting arrested. I was like, well, I don't want to do a sit down again. So we were just moving on. So I think we were in the front group. I think we were about like 6 people who was not getting arrested from the front group.
How many people do you think in the whole
demonstration?
Yeah,
there were only 200 today.
How many police? Probably more, do you think?
Probably more.
Looks like a hell of a lot of
weapons.
Yeah, maybe you made the right choice.
Yeah.
Are you going to be here for a while?
Yeah, I'm living in Copenhagen.
Oh, so. Cool. This has come straight to your doorstep. How's that for you?
It's nice. It's nice. There's a lot of work, and there's no time to go to work, the real work, because we're making a lot of things. So, yeah, I think it's nice.
You met a lot of good people this week?
Yeah, a lot of good people. I'm a little bit disappointed that there were like 100,000 on the street yesterday, and today we were like 200, so I think it sucks, actually.
Well, they arrested almost 1,000 people, didn't they?
Yeah. And they don't have enough space to 1,000 people.
So they had to let them out?
Yeah, so they were cutting some of our friends yesterday, and they were driving around in the big buses, and then they would like dump them in Hvidovre. It's like the shittiest part of Copenhagen, and then because there was no place where they can sit.
Must be at least 100 police here, a lot of them in riot gear, lots of vans and a coach. This just seems to be one protester left on the street, just sitting there shivering with her hands cuffed behind her. I think everyone else has been loaded onto vans, dragged away. So they just seem to be packing up now. But there's 4 helicopters circling overhead, and I can hear dogs barking occasionally, so got the full range of equipment here. So quite awesome, the amount of police presence here. There's a joke going around, in fact, that you can commit a crime anywhere else in Denmark because all the police are here, and it certainly looks like it.
the Copenhagen Daily every day from 11 a.m. till noon throughout the UN Climate Conference on Resonance 104.4 FM and online at resonancefm.com.